Womp womp. Quick disclaimer. Alex and I recorded remote because he was feeling unwell. So his audio is fine. Mine, I recorded in Audacity, didn't set up the right compressor and limiter in advance. So my audio is going to be peaking quite a bit. I tried to my best to like lean back or whatever and keep things even. I'm going to do my best to go through and make it even all the way through. But if this is too much of a tough hang, I totally get it. But check out Signalis. We loved this game. And I'll see you next week. Otherwise, enjoy the episode. Womp womp. All right. I went out. It's Friday. It's not Friday. It is Friday, but actually, what the fuck? Let me start over. I went out to the bars this week because it is Tataru's corporate, Tataru Taro and corporate and company sponsored Pride Month, whatever the bit I decided was.
It sure is.
Yeah. And I, had a really, really bad social interaction.
Oh no.
No. Oh, yes. Because I was just like, keep going, dude. Keep going. I'm farming you. I'm farming this person for content. There's a guy, because I like to go to the bar by myself and just be quiet in a loud place. That's really fun to do sometimes.
No,
and
I totally get that. I do that, too.
Yeah. When I was doing that, I was just working on probably a puzzle on my phone or something. Some guy comes up to me. He's got long, unbrushed hair. An unshaven face with the inability to grow a beard. So, and he just comes up to me and he's like, "Are you here by yourself?"
Which what? Is
the most threatening question. But I was also not threatened by this guy, thankfully, because of my stature. I was like, "Well, I'm much larger than you, so I don't perceive you as a threat." But yeah, he says, and I said, "Uh-huh," to him. And then I'm immediately recognizing like, "Oh, this is about to get weird."
Why would you do that? Why would that be your opener?
Like, that is, yeah, if you're out in a bar and you say, "Are you here by yourself?" That's a threat. Don't say that. Just be like, I noticed, I don't know, do anything else. So he does that. He turns out, though, he's just like, "Yeah." And I didn't ask a follow-up question. I knew he was going to go off. He's like, "Yeah, I'm out here with," I don't remember if he said with a friend or whatever, but he's like, "Yeah, I'm out here. I'm straight. And I'm happy Pride. I'm here being an ally." And I was like,
"Thanks.
You sure are, buddy. You're being a total ally right now.
You came here to the gay neighborhood to show that you're an ally.
It's awesome. You know what? Give our gay bartenders your money. That's fine. Just don't harass your patrons like this guy did. Anyway, he then also tried to start really good conversations like, "So I see you're a fan of button downs."
And what?
Like, your button, I was like, "Yeah, I am in fact wearing a button down right now."
I don't understand what his goal of this interaction was. What did he want to happen?
I was just as baffled as you are, but you know what? I just said yes and moved on. He's like, "Yeah, I like button downs too. Say, your hair, is that a choice?"
What?
Yeah, referring to my, of course, very bald head. I'm like, "Do you think it's a choice? Does it look like one? Like, what are you talking about?"
Has this person?
Yeah, no. What is it? What's your question?
Has this person had a conversation before?
Certainly not. He then just tried to backtrack a little bit. I don't know if he could tell that I was just like annoyed or offended or anything. Maybe I wasn't. I was trying not to put off anything. I was trying to just kind of let it play out just because it was so bizarre while it was happening. Then he's like, "Yeah, oh, you look kind of good with it." I was like, "Cool. I'm like, I don't think your opinion matters." I'm like, "Thanks, I guess." And then he tried to be like, as opposed to asking me, what do I do for work or how do I occupy my time? He asked, "So where do you work?" At that point, I was just like, "I'm not telling you where I work, dude." And he was like, "Whoa, harsh."
Is it like a Russian?
And then left.
It's like a Russian spy. Like what?
I think he's a fucking replica or something. Like he's not human. He's not human. He had a really good accent if he was Russian. But that's That as soon as he turned away and left, I was like, I'm writing this down. This is going directly on the internet.
The moment
I get a chance.
What a wild series of questions. Funny.
Do you like button downs? Is your hair a choice? Where do you work? Oh, preceded by, are you here by yourself?
I also like, even if I thought those were good questions, those would be things I, the not weird versions of those would be what I would ask on a date. Like, I don't know, I would just approach a stranger in a bar and be like, talking about their shirt and their hairstyle.
I don't think I would ask about, I don't know. Those are just not questions I would particularly want to ask. You know, I mean, there's a lot of reasons not to do that. But I think that's a really good tie-in to our game of the week, because boy, is this guy definitely a robot lesbian. No, I'm just kidding. He's a weird, super straight dude.
Is he the one guy robot in the game?
I fucking hope not. Oh my god. We gotta get into that game, so let's get into the episode. We stumble into various strange holes, fiddle with our radio knobs, and scream at the top of our lungs looking for our girlfriend, Insignalis.
Buts, storm of buts, and we're going to tell you about how we saved the world.
Happy Pride to interplanetary robot lesbians only. This is Storm Buds. This is the video game variety show where all the segments are Final Fantasy XIV jokes. And I am your host of light, Jerome Barbatsis. And I am joined by my co-host of Leighton. That's German for light, Alexander Hambrock. Hello.
Happy Pride, everyone. I suggested this game for our Pride Month.
Oh boy, and is it gay?
It certainly is. Gay. It's a lot of other things also.
Nalis is a survival horror top-down shooter, kind of in the style of, I think it draws most of its inspiration, if I had to guess, from a little game you may have heard of called Silent Hill 2.
Silent Hill 2 and Resident Evil. I think those two are really in the mix.
Much more Silent Hill. There's like mechanically some Resident Evil in it. It is developed by Rose Engine, which is two Germans who did a fantastic job. Whose names I forget. You can Google them. Rose Engine. And published by Humble Games and Playism. Playism? Did I write that down or is it Playsim? I think it's Playism. All right, cool. Good confidence. Good energy for the show. The game was released for PC, Switch, PS4, and Xbox One on the 27th of October, 2022. So this is not the most timely episode, but this is just a game that, for me, was kind of released at a time where I had other things to do, including all of 2023 playing those games. Remember that year? That was a busy
vaguely
year. Vaguely, it was also a whirlwind. So this game, I think for the both of us, has been kind of on the back burner, and I'm really glad we took the time to play it this week, because this game is so freaking cool and fucked up and weird and strange and artful and scary and touching. It is a lot of things and also kind of frustrating at times.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the structure of this episode, the first we could talk about this game for hours, so we're gonna. The structure of this episode, A segment, spoiler-free discussion of its mechanics, opinions, things like that, sort of a usual overview of it. We'll do our sponsored segment. We're going to come back. We're going to take a visit to the Spoils Collector, where we full spoiler this game.
Ooh, okay. I was curious about this. It's been almost two years. Mm-hmm.
Like, fuck, we can't not. This game, we're not going to have time to return to it. This game is so buck wild. It is buck wild that I couldn't not talk about this, or I couldn't leave this conversation in our DMs only, because it wouldn't have the full scope, and I want to include everyone as well. We'll start, try and get as many people to play this game as we can, even though it's a couple years old. And also quite similar to apparently another game that came out this year. This is a bit of a tangent, but have you heard of Crow Country?
Vaguely. I've heard the name.
Apparently it's just like this, but a little bit less sapphic. So we'll let's recap sort of the start of the story, the kind of premise that the game launches you into before we go into full spoilers, so that people could hopefully get a tantalizing taste of this game, play it for themselves, come back, listen to the rest of the episode, fully awakened to the delights, the garden of earthly delights that is the game Signalis. You kind of wake up on this abandoned space station and you are a robot girl. You don't really know who you are. You only know that you have one mission, and that is to find somebody. You are looking for a woman named Alina, and you crawl out of your crash-landed vessel. You learn a little bit about what was going on in that vessel. That was just you and Alina in this vessel. And she seems to have woken up much before you, and you chase out after her into the snowy wastes. You find a hole, and then you go down the hole, and then you go in a hole within the hole to arrive in a room. You pick up a book, and shit starts to flash.
Not just any book. You pick up the book, The King in Yellow, which is a real book I'm going to talk a whole bunch about.
Well, yeah. Do you want to talk about it now or later? I don't think... I mean, the details of The King in Yellow, they are thematic.
Yeah, I think let's go over the overview a bit more of the premise, and then let's talk mechanics, and then I want to hit some thematic stuff before the spoiler break.
Okay, so you then wake up. The game at this point shifts between a top-down shooter and kind of a first-person... would say kind of mist-like. Where in certain rooms, you just kind of have to point and click and look around. It's definitely got elements of point and click adventure and elements of top-down shooter horror.
The graphics
games
of this also are of that style that I've really been enjoying a lot in the last few years, which are sort of like pseudo PS1 type graphics, like very low poly, but with like a deliberate sort of low resolution filter passed over it as well. So everything has this kind of like unsettling level of jank to it.
Yeah, I think that is starting to become more on trend, because I believe Crow Country does the same thing. So I'm going to have to check that out as well, because I want more. The overall vibe of this game there is a lot of text being overlaid in Chinese and in German in flashbacks and in propaganda posters. And there's also a little bit of Russian on some of the posters. There's a vaguely Eurasian sort of totalitarian vibe, similar to something like Papers, Please as well, where there's this air of gray over the whole empire. You wake up in what seems to be a mining facility, and you have reason to believe that Alina has gone down to the bottom of the mine, as that is where all gestalt go. And man, anytime there the word gestalt is in a game, you know you're in for wild ride. Right? Like, just the word gestalt evokes such a specific, untranslatable feeling to a game. So if in hearing the word gestalt you are interested, go pick this game up. Even
now, I want to be really clear here. This game does not have gestalts and replicants. That's a different game. This game has gestalts and replicas. It's very different.
But this game very much is Yoko Taro superlative, I would say. Or
yes, it's a lot of things. It's a lot of things superlative, I think.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So there are puzzles to solve, akin to Resident, more closely associated to Resident Evil. There's a lot of like themed. There's some themed keys you got to pick up. There's some items you have to.
It's like half the time you get like an ordinary key you put in the door, and half the time it's like collect these three mystic volumes and put them on the bookshelf to unlock the door.
And the mechanics of the game are also supplemented with a combat system. You are an armed lady. You find various guns throughout your journey and your various ammunition, and you have to manage a raw number of inventory slots, much like Resident Evil 1. But you can adjust the difficulty of the game in a lot of ways. You can adjust the toughness of the of the monsters, and you can also adjust your inventory size, which I've set straight to max.
Oh, you did?
Because oh, I thought, yeah.
I just had to have six slots the whole time, and I did a lot of running back and forth.
I was like, well, this is inflating the playtime of this game and not actually contributing to any sort of tension whatsoever, because there would be parts where it's like, great, I have to pick up three rings and then put them back and then do all this stuff. And I'm like, well,
yeah. So I want to be really clear here. The way the inventory in this game works is by default, you have six inventory slots and everything uses a slot. So each gun you're carrying, inventory slot. Excess ammunition for each gun you're carrying, its own inventory slot. Key items also occupy inventory slots. Health items, each individual type, also an inventory slot. So a lot of the time you're rolling out there with like one gun, one type of ammo, two health items, and two slots for key items, and just running around and making and trying to juggle all of that, and then dancing back and forth between like your safe room where you have your item box in order to try and like shuffle stuff around.
I think dancing is a strong term for that's a really evocative term for it. I think it's more just like trudging. It's certainly the worst part of the game, and I think it could have been. As somebody who played the Resident Evil games I played them when I was old enough. I watched my brothers play them, and certainly that was also the most boring part. And then they started kind of doing a much different, more fun inventory management system in 4 plus. I was like, they could have skipped to 4. They could have had a Diablo style or like a puzzle style inventory management system with sizes. Not that there isn't a lot in this game. I just thought that this was kind of a solved problem already and didn't add too much to it, because it's not like I was going to forsake my guns to like put all three books on the same shelf. I would just take one book, run to the shelf, go back, get another book, run to the shelf, go back, get a book. Like, it was like there was no that was the solution to do it, and it was an unnecessary time sink. And honestly, we got shit to play this month, so I'm not too worried about my choice to up the
inventory. You want to hear something
space.
Wild? I believe that when this game came out, the flashlight module you get halfway through the game also took up an inventory slot, meaning that if you were carry, it takes up one of the gray slots, which you can just have with you in addition to your primary slots.
Oh.
I believe when this game first came out, I think it took up one of your primary inventory slots, so you were down to effectively five anytime that you needed that thing.
I treated the flashlight as if it did have what, so I put it away when I thought maybe I just wasn't paying attention. But that's whatever. Then they've
made a few quality of life updates, I think.
Cool. So That's one aspect of it, and I think the combat is also a little bit iffy for me at most of the time. It's not quite tank controls from the top down shooter, but you do have to stand. You can't move and shoot at the same time. You have to stand still and very slowly like reposition your character until the laser sight lines up with the red box and then fire. And it felt kind of inconsistent at times. If a monster was too close to you, Elster would push them away, but sometimes she would do that at different lengths, and that felt really weird. It was a lot easier. I mean, it was just a lot easier most of the time to ignore things, which is good survival horror gameplay. Like, you're not supposed to kill literally everything. You're not gonna have enough bullets to do that. But it ended up just sort of being frustrating. And what made that frustrating as well is that like there's a really good kind of scary jump scare mechanic wherein sometimes whenever the monsters would see you, and of course there are monsters in this facility, why wouldn't there be? Whenever the monsters would see you, they just scream at the top of their lungs. And it was so annoying going back into the same hallway and getting screamed at like six times. Like, please. It didn't need to be there.
I think for me, like, the combat for me worked because that was the bit that felt like very Silent Hill-ish to me, in that it's sort of like deliberately awkward and deliberately clumsy and deliberately inconsistent. And it's meant to be sort of like, hey, like, you can't really get good at this. It's meant to feel kind of frantic and sloppy, but certainly like that did not make it necessarily fun to play all the time.
No. And I think there are narrative reasons why why Elster should have been able to move and shoot at the same time. we'll get into more of that in the spoiler And the spoils vendor. Where did I say spoils collector? But for now, but it was constantly kind of nagging at me anytime I had to fight. I was like, I should be able to back up and shoot a gun at the same mm-hmm. time or anything, like reposition myself a little bit. It was annoying and kind of frustrating when it should have been kind of panicky instead. I don't know. Maybe those two emotions go hand in hand, but there were times where it was really cool, or there were times where like especially like the boss battles in the game were really intense and really cool. And I was fine trying to take it slow and patient and just observe everything and had the space to work around. But like other times where it was just like a hallway and I'm like, God, please. another thing that can happen is that much like Resident Evil 1, some of the monsters can rise from their grave at seemingly random or scheduled intervals. There's some that feel random and some that feel scheduled, really a little too convenient, where you like go through a hallway, you get a data point, and then it comes back out and you're like, ooh, actually this one wasn't dead. And you're supposed to spend a thermite on it, on the corpse, just to make sure that it doesn't come back up. But there's not really any tell which ones are gonna and which ones aren't.
Yeah, like
so I felt like I wasn't engaging with that as much as I was just using the thermite as a get off me button instead, and then just like treating everything as if it wasn't going to. That worked for me.
Like the way I used the thermite, it actually kind of again worked for me, was like if I was like, okay, I think in this hallway I'm going to be coming through here a whole bunch, this seems like a place where I'm going to run back and forth a lot, let me use the thermite here to like always know that I've got a safe passage through here and not bother with it in the rooms where I feel like I'm gonna be going less often, because it's less likely to be a problem if they respawn in there.
Yeah, it's hard to tell. And I will say that the mechanic itself did add an air of tension to this game, which the game does really well. And I think my favorite parts of the game were where it was tense, where there was always something looming in either the scenery or a threat off in the distance, or just a change in the music, particularly in certain rooms you get a theme playing. Or in certain, just any time the music kind of came on, even if there were no monsters to fight, I felt really like uneasy. And even in spaces where I knew there weren't going to be like monsters coming out of the floor or some other stupid gimmick like that, I felt probably the most scared and most tense navigating through this really incredible solar system world that the game
yes.
has put
and there's one more
that is the best
and thing. There's one more mechanic I want to talk about, but before we do, a little bit more of the world building to contextualize it. So this takes place in this sort of like solar system empire, which is not clear if it's meant to be our solar system or not. It's some kind of hints either direction, but like it's ruled by this kind of like space empire with a lot of like English, German, and Chinese influences, and it's powered by these bio robots, which are not full robots. They're like metal skeletons with like flesh grown over them and like stuff imprinted into and like personalities imprinted into their brains, this is all fairly early on. You learn this pretty quick. All of which is to say that the space empire, despite having colonized different planets and having mining operations and stuff, is stuck, for reasons we'll get into in the spoiler section, at what seems to be like a 60s to 80s level of technology. And one of the last other mechanics in this game is that you also have a radio chip, and you are using your radio chip to tune into broadcast signals that are being used to send information in different parts of the facility. And it's really cool and creepy and eerie, because it's not like you're just like tapping into a Bluetooth signal and like... There's like safe codes, for example. Safe codes will get broadcast over the radio frequency, but it's not like you're tapping into a Bluetooth signal and getting a data packet with a safe code. It's like you're tuning into a super scratchy lo-fi Morse code broadcast that is like sending out these loud beeps that then get translated into numerals. And like and the whole thing has this incredible like long wave radio, or like shortwave long wave radio feel of like scanning random stations and picking up on weird transmissions that you don't fully understand.
It's pretty remarkable what the radio kind of adds to the deciphering and code talking vibe that's going on in this game. I think that was a really clever mechanic. For most of it, there was one puzzle I found really frustrating using the radio because it just wasn't really... There's some puzzles are better than others in this game. But otherwise, I really enjoyed my time with it. I really want to highlight as well the character... well, the art of this game, the especially the background art. You talked about that. I do think that some of the background work is a lot better than maybe like the character portraiture. I think a lot of the pixel art, it's a very anime pixel art style for the character portraits, which I think was probably a less effective version of something like Norco's pixel art, which also I think came out in 2022. That game's pixel art characters had a lot more depth to it. For me, it looked like a lot of these character portraits just sort of had a highlight color, a base color, and a shading color, and maybe a gradient in certain areas for their skin tones or their other things. The character arts outside of the rendered spaces felt really, really... really a bit flat for me. The character designs are cool, but otherwise, yeah, they just could have been more color and detail and richness in that aspect of it. But otherwise, the art in this game is really exceptional.
Well, the art and the art direction, a couple of things. I agree with the character portraits being kind of flat. I think the anime style actually has some thematic stuff that's worth talking about that I want to talk about when we get to the theme things. But like,
okay, yeah, I suppose it's more Asian. Like, there's a lot of Asian influence. Well, in this game, I mean the main, mm-hmm. Yeah.
And like, but yes, like the overall art direction, and especially like the overall cutscene direction, and the way that like on screen effects are used. Major flashing light warning: do not play this game if you have epilepsy, probably. But a lot of really creative stuff with like I'm going to talk a lot about various references that this game is obviously pulling from. One of the ones that was coming up a lot for me was the original Japanese Ring movie, which did a lot of sort of similar on-screen stuff with text and flashing and quick cuts and things like that to signal sort of like various mental things going on in messing with perception and messing with sort of like, you know, for lack of a better term, like psychic things.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, the cinematography of this game is pretty exceptional, and the storytelling, the way the story is told, is very, you're not going to get a lot of answers until you finish it and then start to watch a bunch of YouTube videos about the lore, as I'm sure both of us have done at this point already, just to be like, what was that? But speaking of what it was, I mean, we're at about enough time to split into our B segment, so I'm gonna go piss on Ronald Reagan's grave. And then when we get back and during that time, we'll do our ad segment, right? Then when we get back, we'll take a little visit to the spoils collector. We'll see you then.
We're gonna read some ads.
Okay, this week we are sponsored by Eternity's Chime. Experience a story of love, loss, heartbreak, a triumph of human dignity that critics have called the best TV show of the last decade and one of the towering achievements of the 21st century so far. Nominated for 3 Emmys, 2 Critic Choice Awards, and 5 Golden Globes, the series makes its way to Tovo.io this weekend after being canceled after only 5 episodes during its original run on Disney+, due to only being watched by 6 million people. Now, Tovo has rescued the series and given it a new home, but we've been told that they'll only fund production for the rest of the series if enough people watch it this weekend. That's right. You have to watch it right now. You have about 16 hours to watch the show and save it from oblivion, or the last Eternity's Chime to ever exist will be that cliffhanger with Martha and Alice locked in the janitor's closet after that drug dealer went bad. If you watch next weekend or even on Monday, it doesn't matter. The entire fate of the show hinges on if all of our listeners go and watch 7 hours of prestige TV in one sitting before the end of day today, because this is how these metrics work. So, we have been sponsored by Eternity's Chime to encourage people to go out and watch the entire thing. And you've seen the whole thing, right, Jerome? You're all caught up?
I am all caught up. I really hope we get a season 2 because I personally need to know what's going to happen with Dwight and Karina, right?
It's that crazy. On the boat? Yeah.
On the boat, they have to perform an emergency root canal. And Dwight, his dentistry license expired. What are they going to do?
And like and that scene when the strings come in and you see the pathos in his eyes as he contemplates what he has to like do to make this happen. It hit me in a way that I have not experienced probably since I watched Toy Story for the first time when I was 6.
Oh my gosh, absolutely. And when Trevor comes in from the lower decks and is like, you guys, you're not going to believe this. We are out of mayonnaise. No!
It was the one. Everything hinged on it.
Everything hinged on that, and it faded. It faded over, and we just, we got it. We have to watch Eternity's Chime on Tova.io.
We have to save it.
We need to see if that emergency root canal goes through.
This is dropping on Sunday morning, so I think you've got about a day and a half, or like half of a day rather, to watch the entire thing in one sitting. And
yeah. That should do it.
Should go without
how
saying.
How long? What's the total runtime on that one again?
Like 7.5 hours across 5 episodes.
7.5 hours across 5 episodes. So if you were planning on doing anything on this date, the 9th of June, right? That's the 9th of June. Awesome. Cool. If you're planning on doing it on that date, if you're going to your sister's wedding, no. If you're planning on taking care of your sick cat, taking it to the vet, that cat can wait.
You haven't put it on in the waiting room at the vet, and if they don't subscribe to Tovo.io, you get them to sign up.
You pay for it.
That's right. You have them add it to your charge. You're like, hey, this is for the vet visit. This is for the drugs. This is for Tovo.io.
Awesome. Yeah. Cool. Now that our priorities are in order, you should check out Eternity's Chime on Tovo.io right now.
No.
Immediately. Now. Ah! I'm dying.
Thank you to Eternity's Chime for sponsoring our show.
Okay, and I'm back from jail.
I had to bail you out, so you owe me like what, $4,500? But
yeah, I do owe you that. So they did. They caught me pissing on that grave, and they cited me for exposure. Really?
I was gonna say, you know, they felt kind of sheepish about it, but they had to arrest you anyway. But actually, no, the cops would be thrilled to arrest you for that.
Yeah, no, they would be. They were pretty thrilled to arrest me for it, but they didn't. They were like, well, they saw the exposure, and they're like, well, this certainly isn't indecent. It's actually pretty decent. But we're gonna have to expose you. We're gonna have to set you in anyway. And
ain't
like, well,
ain't that just how it is?
That's how they got
George Michael.
They my therapist told me to learn how to accept a compliment, so I just kind of went along with it. So yeah, I said thank you, and then we bailed out, and now we're back here to talk more about Signalis. This is a kind of a first for us, where like both the A and B segment are just the same. Well, not really, I guess, since Final Fantasy 14 we've done that, but this is way different because we are taking a visit. We've been at the Diadem. We got all our Sky Pirate spoils. Is that where they come from? I don't remember. I never did that I did do that content. Whatever. There's an NPC in Final Fantasy 14 called the Spoils Collector, and we're visiting him. Full spoiler warning for Signalis, a game that came out in 2022, but like most people, you probably put it on the back burner because there were Baldur's Gate 3 and other shit.
There were so many games coming out.
There were so many games. You have been warned. We are at the Spoils Collector, and we are about to turn in all of our spoils. We will see you when you get back from playing this game, or just ta-ta for until next week if you're just never going to play it, but you still don't want to be spoiled. I don't know. I don't live your life. Do what you want. But now we're going to talk about... Holy fuck!
Okay, so...
This game is so wild!
Before we talk plot stuff, I want to give my thesis on a lot of the thematic stuff, okay?
Okay, Men in Yellow.
And this game in general is a game with a lot of very, like, explicit sort of homages or callbacks to, like, other types of media. Like, it's very naked about it, right? I mean, some of it works better for me than others. The shining carpet's a little bit much. But, like, there's a lot of Blade Runner in here, obviously.
Wait, you don't like the bioresonance?
No. There's a lot of Blade Runner in here. Honestly, a lot of the Empire stuff, even more like just like less mass market stuff. But Nine Fox Gambit is a sci-fi novel from about 8 years ago that a lot of reminded me with like the whole Imperial spacefaring stuff felt resonant of that. But I figured I'd narrow it down. There are two major sort of like very explicit influences on this work that I think are worth talking about. And the first is The King in Yellow, which is a... Oh, I'm going to get this name wrong. One sec. So The King in Yellow is a book of short stories by Robert Chambers, who was an American author operating in the late 19th century, and it is most famous for being acknowledgedly a very large influence on H.P. Lovecraft. The King in Yellow is kind of considered to be sort of like the first set of cosmic horror stories. And it deals with like the premise of it. The first couple of stories basically deal with this idea of this figure of the King in Yellow, who is a sort of like religious icon that people seem to worship, who like invites people to go to his kingdom, kind of like beyond the night sky, and dance there. And like, and it's all the very good sort of creepy, like, you know, stuff that Lovecraft is known for. And for reasons that will make a lot of sense when we talk about the plot, very obviously an influence on this game. Like, there's a lot of cosmic horror in here, a lot of like the unknowable stuff that drives you mad out beyond the stars and like causes weird things to happen with minds and bodies and stuff like that. What I do think is interesting is that The King in Yellow, I've read this collection of stories. The first few stories are this proto-cosmic horror stuff. The back half of them are really just more sort of like literature stories, kind of like in touch with like what I would call like the movements of like romanticism and asceticism, and even like the decadent movements of the late 19th century. And like they're all about sort of like, you know, like bohemian artists living in Paris and stuff like that. And I actually think those two things are not as disconnected as they seem, in so much as while Chambers was not like as explicitly massively racist as Lovecraft, there is also a good amount of racism in there. And there is a good amount of sort of like the two dovetailing in the sense of like a reflection of a hegemonic kind of cultural imperialism and the things that it fears being the things that are outside of, like, you know, the spheres of what it considers to be rational knowledge. And this is the line of critique people have leveraged at Lovecraft a lot, but I think it also completely applies to the to both halves of The King in Yellow, in terms of sort of like the obsession with like the aesthetics of beauty and artistry and indulgence, and also the nightmarishness of sort of like, you know, of something that drives you mad from beyond the stars. And I think both of those are actually kind of at play here in terms of like the obvious cosmic horror stuff, but also the stuff to do with the way that this is also like a game about kind of this Imperium. And even like, in, as we learn a bit later on, like the sort of spin-off nation that seems to still just replicate the sort of like almost fascistic structures of the Empire that it escaped from.
Actually, I want to correct you here. I couldn't before, but there were two empires. There's the empire, there's the original empire with the empress herself, who had major bioresonant abilities and brought the solar system together, united under what was largely a more peaceful and prosperous society, though it did have its, you know, mining colonies and whatnot. Like, it couldn't have been perfect. But then there was this rebellion that was a response to it, that styled itself the other empire or whatever, like the Usen or Eusen, I guess, if we're talking about German empire. Or was it the other one? There was like there's the emperor with the empress, and then the empire, there's like a rebellion, and that rebellion is the much more fascist techno state sort of stuff.
Okay.
That we're coming under now. And those, that duality is slightly mirrored in The King in Yellow. But I think what's more mirrored is that, yes, there's this cosmic horror, and then there's this artistry and decadence, and then there's this desire in this game. The character who we first think is Alina So is actually Ariane Young, and she is this despondent, artistically minded, you know, decadent, like loving of the patron of the arts in a militaristic imperialist society that is the rebellion. She's born on the outermost mining colony with her aunt in a radio room, right, which is like the whole radio theme. We enter into her radio room at the very start. We pick up her radio and we work through the world with that radio at our side, which is sort of Elster's connection to Ariane herself, kind of a guiding factor through this world, which the world itself I want to talk about a lot more, because I think the setting is such a major character in this story. But to do so, we have to talk explicitly about Ariane and what her desires are. And I want to finish my point here. She is conflating. She's conflicted with, not even conflicted. She hates the Empire and she wants to pursue the arts. But in so doing, has to escape the Empire into deep space and succumb herself to the terrors of the cosmic horrors and her latent bioresonant. As she kind of dies over the course of this sort of mission that is Folly, she's assigned to, her bioresonant powers start to resonate and mix with her desire for the arts. And there's this classical music that keeps sort of pulsing its way through various sections of the world that wouldn't really make sense otherwise. You said before, like, there are hints that this is our world and that, like, the classical music kind of ties in to there, because there's like the Moonlight Sonata and things like that kind of pulsing through. But also it's very possible that this isn't our world, and the world is such a central figure here. What were you gonna say?
I was gonna say, there's one other kind of what I think is like major line of influence to think about with this game, before we like start getting into specifics, which is also, I think it's worth talking about this game in the context of anime broadly, because like obviously there's specific stuff like Evangelion and Ghost in the Shell. Evangelion and Ghost in the Shell are both all over this game, but I would say like even on like a level up from that, if there's sort of like a lot of anime has a preoccupation or is sort of like interested in the topics of subject formation and kind of and social reproduction. Like, this is why so much anime is set in high schools, why so much anime is set in institutions, why a very common theme is sort of like, you know, adults manipulating or controlling children or directing them towards their own ends, or like, or producing sort of like social phenomena out of the use of children and teenagers. Like, and what I mean by social reproduction and subjective formation is just the process that we go through as we especially go through adolescence, of kind of like coming to an understanding of what the social world is and what it expects of us and what it will mean for us to be a person in that world. And that is all over this game. Like,
it's all over this game, which is, it's ironic because the replicas aren't, they don't go through this process ostensibly. However, the replicas do. There are documents all over this game that suggest, or actually that are classified, that explain how replicas will have their gestalt memories resurface if they're triggered by certain things. And of course, the key thing here for Elster is that once you get really late into the game and you open the classified document about Elster, you learn that her gestalt memories are triggered by personal connection with someone else, which is exactly what Ariane did not learn, because she did not open the envelope, which was the coolest shit ever. Like, that whole like fake out ending into learning more about what was going on before the mission, which I haven't even made the mission explicit yet. The mission is also crucial to this story, into like making it very explicit what the relationship between Elster and Ariane was in the game. That was a super highlight for me. Loved the implication that, you know, our memories are somehow transferable like that. Obviously, I'm a sucker for that kind of shit with Final Fantasy XIV.
Yeah, and just like, and like the note we keep hitting over and over is that this nation from which they hail is just engaged in this vast project of like forcible social reproduction, like on multiple levels, right? It's both that they're growing these bio droids and then like forcibly implanting, you know, personalities into them to literally make them into the types of people that they think that they need. But it's also when we get that flashback to that school kind of halfway through, and we see again, like, even we even get the impression that like it's like the young women that we see are wearing like a mixture of like a schoolgirl outfit and what appears to be like some almost like a Nazi uniform, and it's this idea of like almost Starship Trooper style. One gets the impression that like that citizenship and service to sort of like, you know, the state are one and the same within the setting, that everyone is engaged in sort of this extremely rigid and extremely imposed kind of like forcible like social structure.
Yeah, they of course the more obvious themes are that they are bullying this girl because she has white hair, this poor Ariane girl. And the bullying, of course, leads her to feel even more ostracized because of the society, as in these things tend to do, tend to devalue and want to literally beat the arts out of her. So she will do anything to get away. So that's where she signs up for the Penrose program, which is a space exploration program where she just gets to go off and be by herself in space, which is sounds like paradise to her. But wow, does that turn into not paradise?
It turns out that it's fun for a while, and then it's very much not when you're like, okay, and now I'm out here in the dead of space. And nothing's going to happen, and I guess I'm just going to slowly die.
Going to wait, hopefully wait to find something to land on. So that's why she makes the connection with Elster, who she's not supposed to, but whatever, she's a rebel. And then the biggest revelation of... Well, there's two big revelations in this game. Actually, maybe three I want to talk about. The first one is that... well, of course, excluding the fact that... Elster's gestalt memories were coming to where she was conflating Alina with Ariane because the two looked similar, and then her gestalt was in love. So her gestalt form or memory was in love with the woman named Alina, and she adopted two twin sisters who then became the friend of Ariane, mm-hmm. right? So there's like this weird connection, weird kind of almost Woody Allen connection. But Elster and the gestalt are like, are they the same person or are they different? I would posit that they're very different, though. That's a question a lot of games have tackled, again including Final Fantasy 14 and Cyberpunk. But you then learn that the mission is basically doomed for them. If they, by around cycle 3000, they get missive to say, well, you're in the final phase, and if you haven't found somewhere to land, you're not going to, because the radiator is going to, or the reactor is going to start leaking radiation, and you're gonna die slow, agonizing death. It is recommended that your replica kill you, have your replica kill you. And normally Elster would have no problem doing that, but Ariane fell in love with her. And she fell in love with Ariane, so they had a problem doing that. So eventually Ariane becomes this sort of ever-living, bioresonant, cancerous growth in her cryopod. And she starts to, as the real Elster dies in the real world, Ariane starts to use her bioresonant powers to sort of astrally project and create this other world in which the game takes place.
Okay, so is that what we... Is that what we think is going on there? Because I would...
That's why I mean, this game is so open to interpretation, but, like, there's... That, to me, is pretty concrete, because, like, once you get the fake ending, and then you go back into where the ship is, and you see yourself... I mean, throughout the game, you see... body, you see your own body multiple times in multiple different places, in like the elevator shaft where the Adler has executed you many times before, in the other place, like every time where Adler has killed you in this loop, there's something like, there's obviously a time loop of sorts happening, and that's not happening in the real quote-unquote world. That is sort of happening within Ariane's reconstruction of this world. She is like living in this infinite prison in space of not ever dying because of her bioresonant abilities, but also not living because of the cancer and the growths and the radiation of the cosmic radiation and the ship's radiation kind of tormenting her. So she's using these bioresonants to kind of create physical manifestations of the people she knows. And eventually... She does two. The loop gets broken. Well, the loop gets broken a couple ways. She resonates with. She lures, maybe either Elster or it's not clear how. But Falk, the commander replica, gets lured down into the heart of the memory where Ariane is lying, and then imprints, and accidentally or inadvertently maybe imprints. Imprints the love for Ariane into Falk, which fucks with Falk massively. That was a huge revelation. That was like right at the end too. I was like, oh my god, that would suck so bad. But it was causing this commander to degrade because suddenly gestalt memories were activating within this supposedly impenetrable person that everything else was bioresonant with, the Calibri units, everything else in the station was bioresonant with in her memory. So suddenly now everyone's turning into this, she's reconstructing these horrifying versions that Elster has to go through and kill and learn how to kill to actually be able to kill, work through and kill Ariane in the end, right? And then the other thing she does is she summons a copy of the twin sisters, or at least one of the twin sisters, to go down and look for her sister. That copy of the twin sister ends up successfully killing Adler, letting Elster get through to Ariane, and then she goes down to the reproduction of the bookstore that they used to live at to find that her twin sister was no longer alive, and then she kind of deconstructs into this sort of nasty, psychotic pile.
Yep, it's gross.
And then Elster is able to continue on her journey without much interference from Adler. A little bit, but she is able to get a lot farther because of Issa stabbing the Adler in the eye. That was a fantastic kind of revelation. Like, you look through Adler's journey, he's like, there's a girl that's never been in this loop before. That's weird. And then that girl ends up stabbing him and kicking him down a pit. I was like, yeah! So cool.
So everything that you say there matches my understanding with one kind of exception, and this could just be an ambiguity, but it's like my impression was that that Ariane, like after she's sort of like decomposing or whatever in the pod, my impression was that the ship then crashes on this kind of ice planet, which is where like the Red Gate is buried in the earth, and like she ends up connecting with it and gaining its power, or it gains her power, or both.
I don't think so.
Okay.
I'll tell you why. So there's a piece of media in the game that explains what the Red Gate is. The Red Gate is essentially, like, scientifically and observedly in this universe, a copy of Jupiter's eye on its planet.
Oh, okay.
And that's
okay,
just something that people ended up worshipping. And thus, they can't actually have crashed on Lang because they are 3,000 days or cycles away from the solar system at this point. They couldn't have just turned the ship around.
Womp womp. As I'm editing this, I'm realizing that from a time perspective, it's not impossible that Ariane couldn't have turned the ship around, because the last data entry you get is actually 2,500 or so cycles after the missive. So maybe she could have, but she was also really, really sick. So at that point, maybe Elster did turn the ship around. It's not necessarily made explicit, but it would have been, it's possible. It's not impossible. Womp womp.
Got it. Well, so I guess then here's my question. My question then is this. Does the base that we spend the majority of the game going through, does it actually exist? Is Falk and Adler and all the rest of them, are they real people?
Those were people that existed. It's hard to tell, but like they definitely existed in the universe and they had an impact on, Ariane's compulsory service or something, because she was stationed
but we do think that this whole thing might be a construction of hers, though.
Because of her bioresonant abilities and her position out in space, and like apparently she was super powerful, but like she didn't engage with the Empire in any way, or it was hard to detect or something, she is using that to actually create this world. Like, she is kind of a god in this sense, and that she has created this world. It's sort of a dream. It's a very Tetsuya Nomura sort of dream is real, not real. Or I guess Final Fantasy 14, the fucking Yoshida. what is a dream and what is a summoning? She's kind of summoning this whole thing, and then is being asked, she's constructing this Elster, this vision of her lover, to finally fulfill her promise that she couldn't prior.
Okay, that all makes sense. I mean, well, if it sounds confusing when we're talking about this, it's because a lot of this is very ambiguously presented in the game itself.
But if you played the game, this should all make sense. And there's one final piece of evidence I want to put forth that should help convince you that this is, if you're not already, that this is all sort of constructed as sort of a training ground for Elster to fulfill her promise. It is actually the mechanics of the ending itself. Have you looked this up?
No, I have not. Or like, I saw a wiki page, but I didn't look up
there's
much else.
There are several endings to this game, not including the fake out. There's the one which you're probably going to get if you play through it normally, which is the promise ending, wherein Elster finally successfully is able to keep her promise, kill Ariane, and then go to the end. And there's also the secret ending in the cave or whatever, the base or whatever. However, then you get shown a bunch of stats and you're like, what? Maybe you're like, I was like, what are those stats all about? But I also wasn't about to fucking replay this game or to see if there are other endings. But it turns out if you play the game two different ways, you get two different endings. If you play the game in like a really pacifist way and you don't kill anyone and you don't train Elster to learn how to be brutal and kill people, she doesn't. She just gets to the ship at the end and then she's like, I can't do it, and turns around and dies in the desert or whatever. Or if you don't spend enough time with the constructs in the game and you like don't, if you just sort of rush through it, even if you kill some people and you don't spend enough time learning about the world itself as Elster, Ariane doesn't remember who you are. Like Elster, you haven't made enough of an impression on Ariane's psyche to actually know. And then Elster's like, well, how do I, like, Ariane doesn't convince, because she doesn't know who Elster is, she doesn't convince her to kill her. Kill Elster to kill her. There's a lot of her in this game, which is great, but it makes a sentence like that confusing. So there's the mechanics of that. Like, this is all sort of like training ground for Elster. Like, she has this opportunity to make an Elster able to kill, which is so cool.
It's really cool. Well, and like, and thinking about it that way also, then the whole thing being a construction, which to be clear is also very real. She's remaking reality.
That's what I'm saying. She's like, she's summoning this thing. Mm-hmm. It's not that she's just like having a nightmare and it's a Saint Elsewhere kind of deal. She is summoning this Ultima Thule style. Like, these are emotions made real based on dynamis.
But then also, like, the idea that, like, that she has created this place, but also she is incapable of not infecting it, right? That, like, that something about her,
the cancer is, like, fucking with everything.
Mm-hmm. My God, the first time you get to one of the, what is it, like, the Mina, I think is her name?
Just the blood pours out.
Exactly.
Of her head. Cool.
So that was the first real image in the game where I was like, okay, we're doing some stuff here. I have not seen something quite like this before.
It's truly exceptional. And I've pretty much exhausted all I want to gush about this game about, because like, yeah, I've already complained about the mechanics of it, but the story in the world's so good. There's so many ways to interpret this game. What else did you want to call out before, because we're at about time here, what else did you want to call out before we hit the hay on this one?
I mean, I think one last thing it's worth sort of talking about, and I actually don't know if we'll have much to say about this, but I want to bring it up because I think it's at least, do we think that we have, what do we think this game is doing with gender? Because it's doing something.
It certainly is doing something. It's making, if nothing else, given that there's only one character in this game and that's male, and that male character is the adversary, even like is more of an antagonist. Like, yeah, sure, maybe Falk is the final boss, but like she has to be a woman in order for her to get the love that Elster has. The real main antagonist of this game is kind of, or maybe a deuteragonist. I don't know. Is the man, the one man, who may or may not be the traitor from
the
Gestalt or something. Like, yeah, maybe that's all open interpretation as well. It is certainly a matriarchal, or just like, it's certainly a woman first game, and it's talking about an experience, a specific experience of lesbian love, which is still queer love, and it still touches on themes of queer love being, queer lives being cut short, which is very common in these sorts of games, if you haven't picked up on that.
Yeah.
It is an intensely feminist game. Most of the workers, laborers, and caretakers in this society are all, are all women, which is to say that they, I would say the authors are suggesting that we as a society view the women of our world as sort of the omni laborer, the ones that work harder, get exploited. That's mostly the exploited class. And the one male replica is actually just the cozy admin job.
Yeah, no. There's something definitely there. And there's something it's doing that I can't quite nail down. And to be clear here, possibly not even like is meant to be nailed down. Like a lot of this game can be deliberately ambiguous or just open to interpretation.
Yeah.
Something about the specifics of like, it's not just that all the workers are women. It's that most of the ones you're going to interact with throughout the game are like are robots, are produced, are manufactured, right? And yes. And their design also is kind of fetishy. They have paint on their legs that looks like they're wearing thigh-high stockings. Like, it is, there's something with sort of like the way that the designs are pulled together that just, and the way that that even intersects with sort of like, you know, with the imperialism of this non-empire nation and something, and like how I don't know where to get with it, but it is something that is like in play in the mix here that I kept kind of like finding my mind alighting on as I was playing through this game.
Yeah, it may take more time for us to fully realize our thoughts on this game because it's extremely complicated and deep story-wise, and there are plenty more YouTube videos for us to consume on the lore. But if you have thoughts or disagreements about Signalis and you want to share them with us, the best avenue to do so would be, of course, to join our Discord or reach out to us on socials. Those links are in the description as well of this episode, as they are as and with every other episode. And hey, if you're listening to us for the first time, welcome. We have a lovely back catalog of games that we've been playing for the past couple months. You can go visit our Fallout month, but most importantly, we do have a catalog of Final Fantasy 14 recap content for the first like 45 episodes. Go back and listen to that because you know what's fast approaching is Final Fantasy 14 Dawn Trip.
Yeah, it's almost
that
here.
That is coming up, so that's going to be kind of the star of next month for sure. So just wanted to throw a bone to our Final Fantasy 14 listeners that yes, of course, we will be talking extensively about Dawn Trail once it's out. Probably every B segment in the month of July is just going to be us gushing about what the hell we got up to in Dawn Trail. And then we'll do a big one. I wanted to like just because I think the Dawn Trail hype is starting to get real. So I want to just say we'll be there with you and we could talk to us in our Discord about it. Well, mostly me or to Alex on Blue Sky. That seems to be the dichotomy of our social medias. I also wanted to plug our new Twitch channel, the twitch.tv/stormbudslive. We had a test stream that was as of the previous Saturday. And we are going to stream again this upcoming Saturday, and we are going to be working through Tataru's Grand Endeavor on live stream because we want to
Saturday the 15th.
Yeah, that's the plan.
Shit, we need to talk offline. I may not be around that particular day, but we will stream Tataru's Grand Adventure.
Okay. Okay, yeah, sure. I'll have to make an edit. That's fine. Yeah, we can. Great.
Sorry.
No, that was fine. If we talk offline, I'll just cut in what the actual date is prior or now. I don't know. I might not edit this full thing out, but that's how this thing works. We do really want to make sure that we're streaming regularly, though, yes. And routinely. Let's make sure we do that going forward. We also, let's see what I wanted to announce. I'm going to cut the side quests out because we talked exclusively about Signalis for a long time. We could talk about that next week. And you can support us without spending a single of your bullion or maybe your fiat currency. You can review the podcast on your podcast platform of choice. Most of you are on Spotify, but Apple Podcasts also could use some more love there. You could also, of course, by interacting with our socials and interacting with us, you're increasing our motivation and interest in performing with this. We also have finished our poll for the 6:30. I was going to announce it last week and then I cut it out because the poll wasn't done. But now we're going to announce it. The winning game for the end of Pride Month is, of course, Life is Strange, True Colors. That's the one we picked, right? Yeah, Life is Strange, True Colors. But second place, real close, Bugsnax.
Almost made it.
Almost made it. Don't worry. And we had a write-in as well. That was a really good idea for Deltarune and Undertale. So, you know, thank you for sharing your interest in those games with us. We have them in our sights. We will get to those as well if you are interested in us talking about those. But for this month, we are at the end of the month we're going to talk about Life is Strange, True Colors. So that's going to be our 6:30 episode. And our next episode on the 16th, you want to, is that, that's not Tataro Taro's Grand Endeavor.
No,
why don't you tell us what that is, Alex?
That's going to be I Was a Teenage Exocolonist.
Oh, that's right. No wonder I forgot about that game. Okay.
So that should be fun.
Hopefully that's a little change of pace. Not that I don't want more Signalis.
No, based on just the screenshots, I think it's going to be a change of pace from Signalis.
Well, without much further ado, I've begged for your support. I've plugged the stream. Check. Announce the next game. I think that's going to do it here for this episode of Storm Buds. I have been your host of Light, Jerome Barbatsis, and I was joined by my co-host of Light, Alexander Hambrock. Say goodbye to the buds right now.
Auf Wiedersehen.